frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on May 8th, 2017, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate joins me to discuss the French presidential election outcome and the Republican healthcare bill's Senate chances. All that and much more is coming up. Arsenal for Democracy is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. It's Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me again this week in studio is Nate. Hi, Nate.
Great to be back, Bill.
So we were off last week, but we were Nate and I have been busy going to various protests and rallies and things like that. We hope that folks had a chance to listen to last week's episode, which I think was pretty interesting, or the week before that, the discussion on climate change and what's going to have to happen there that I did with Jonathan. We got clips of that also up on the SoundCloud, which is linked from arsenalfordemocracy.com. And those clips are there, like if you wanted to share it, kind of the highlight. I do that occasionally if there's a particularly good little segment, so you can promote that to folks. And we actually don't talk about that much on the show, but it would definitely really help if listeners go to the iTunes page and, you know, put in a rating to, you know, if you like the show. Let us know, give us feedback. You can always tweet at us, AFD Radio. You can talk to us on the Facebook page. You can talk to me at Bill Humphrey MA on Twitter. Lots of different ways to reach us and let us know that you like and appreciate the show, because sometimes it can be a little hard to gauge how many people are listening, not just to the web podcast version, but also to the radio show in Delaware, which airs during rush hour. So, you know, maybe folks aren't in front of their computers. They might be driving while they're listening or something. But if you do like the show, you know, just let us know, rate the show, that sort of thing. And we'll, you know, keep on producing this good content. We're going to start this week by talking about the situation in France. The presidential election just happened yesterday as we're recording this. And Emmanuel Macron, as expected, was the, you know, centrist candidate facing off against Marine Le Pen, the neo-Nazi candidate, and he did prevail easily over her in the second round. So pretty much went as we had projected when Nate and I discussed this last, you know, a couple months back, you know, in terms of who was going to be there and more or less how it was going to probably turn out. There was obviously a lot of drama in the first round of whether or not it was actually going to be those two candidates, but then in the end, there wasn't actually that much drama when the final results came for that either. But, you know, it's a little bit more of a complicated picture than just, oh, Macron won easily. So we do want to talk a little bit about that. Nate, what from your perspective is kind of the big set of headlines out of this outcome?
Well, I mean, I think it's obviously great that, you know, there was a clip going around of Le Pen crying after her defeat. And obviously anytime fascists lose like that, it's good. But it's also important to point out that her poll numbers went significantly up from the last time the National Front ran. So, you know, on the one hand, she was defeated. On the other hand, the trend line is going up. So that's definitely something to watch out in the future, especially if, you know, the same sort of austerity agenda is pursued through Macron and, you know, there's continual liberalization and cuts of various things, and that could potentially bolster the National Front going forward. So I think it's probably pretty important to try to combat that and make sure that, you know, this is the closest they ever get to taking power, which admittedly isn't that close considering that I believe she came in third behind abstentions So there clearly was a large group of voters who were definitely not supporting her, but they were not really that enthusiastic about Macron either. So I think that's a situation we have to look at going forward. And Bill and I were just talking about the upcoming elections for the French Parliament and how that's all going to shake out. And I don't even believe they've announced the candidates yet. I think that's still coming in a week or so. And then the parliamentary elections will be on, I believe, the 13th of June. So that's about a month and a half or so to go in terms of that.
Yeah, and I also, like Nate, I think that sort of the big story here is kind of how the final percentages broke down, because a lot of the news coverage said, you know, oh, Macron got 65% of the vote or something, you know, it was 30 points ahead of Le Pen. And again, that's good. But there is also clearly immense dissatisfaction for all the discussion about how, you know, the French have a quote unquote better presidential election system than the U.S. I mean, it's true they don't have an electoral college, so that's probably an improvement. But, you know, the runoff system is somehow a better way of doing things. That's not entirely clear to me. My good friend Etienne sent me the statistics this morning, and he said that if you looked, you know, if you included all the, you know, abstention ballots, there's literally a box you check off to say you're formally not voting for either of them. Or if you count the blank ballots where they go and they just completely cast a blank ballot, or, you know, null invalid votes where they either mess something up or intentionally spoil the ballot. You know, that it's basically 44% rather than 65% for Macron, 25% abstaining, which is huge, and 22% for Le Pen, and then 9% for blank or invalid votes. And again, that to me is kind of one of the big stories here, because, you know, there was all this talk about, look, you know, it's a top two system. We narrowed it down to the top two people, and it's not even really necessarily the top two parties, because neither of them are backed by a major party. Neither of them are probably going to have that much major party support in the assembly. I mean, Macron will get along fine with, you know, many of the parties because of the kind of the platform and not quote unquote non-ideological position that he was running from. But in general, like, that shows you that there's kind of a serious problem when a quarter of the people vote abstain formally, and then 34% either did that or had, you know, blank or invalid ballot. And also that 44% number is very similar to the number that Bill Clinton got in 1992 in the popular vote. You know, that was partly because Ross Perot was running and, you know, drew 18%, but, a lot of times people kind of misremember Bill Clinton as having this huge victory because he got 370 electoral votes because of how the electoral college system works. But again, he really only got 43% of the vote. And this to me indicates there's sort of this third force, which is not uncommon. I mean, that's literally a concept in French politics, third force or tripartism, things like that. That's not the same as what happened here, but it is not unprecedented for there to be sort of a three camp system in France. And that's not necessarily the best reflected in a runoff system like this. Plus the runoff system was always kind of expected to just, you know, get it down to the top two major candidate, like major party candidates. And that really didn't happen here.
Yeah, so it seems like there's going to be a lot of shakeup as this election comes up, and there's some discussion of whether there's going to be some of the mainstream or more moderate Republican party, and whether how they're going to sort of whether they're going to try to work with Macron and maybe form that sort of center block, as we're sort of talking about sort of three different camps, whether that could happen. I think there was a recent poll showing that there could potentially be between 250 and 290 MPs, or I guess they're not called MPs technically in France, but in a 577 strong chamber. So they could potentially have quite a big group. But at the same time, there was also a poll from Le Monde that found that 61% of voters did not want Macron to command an absolute majority in the National Assembly. So he actually renamed his party somewhat. Now it's called La République En Marche instead of just En Marche. So maybe they're trying to attract the center right a little bit, try to bring them into the fold. And there's still quite a possibility that there's going to be a pretty strong Republican party coming out of these presidential or the parliamentary elections. I think it's also worth noting that after the campaign of Jean-Luc Mélenchon, which sort of caught fire towards the end, his party, France Insoumise, or Unbowed, or whatever it's called, they're going to try running candidates a lot of different elections. They could potentially pick up some seats. So I think it's going to be quite interesting, you know, what base of support does Macron have to implement his agenda going forward, or will he be sort of constantly having battles with the National Front picks up some seats, because they currently don't really have that many seats in the actual French parliament. They have much more seats, including Marine Le Pen, in the European parliament. So, you know, how is that all going to shake out? Will he get support from his large sort of middle bloc, or will he be battling the right and the left at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know for sure. My gut instinct is that a lot of his En Marche candidates are going to be right-leaning ex-socialists, people who generally backed him. I mean, the Socialist Party abandoned their candidate more or less in the first round in favor of him. And he, when he was finance minister under the current president a few years back, he basically got this huge quote-unquote economic reform package rammed through that was fairly conservative, and it was backed by, or I should say it was market liberal, we'll call it, and that was backed by the Socialist Party leadership in the assembly. Not necessarily a lot of members happy about that, but it went through anyway, so, you know, that kind of shows you where the Socialists are at right now. I think a lot of people are anticipating a pretty severe collapse for the Socialists, but that could also just translate into En Marche picking up a bunch of seats. What I think is probably pretty likely, though, is a Republicans, formerly known as the UMP, center-right party picking up either a majority or pretty close to it. And I think that, honestly, I don't see how he would be uncomfortable working with them. Like, you know, sometimes in the past there have been situations that, you know, where a socialist president was working with the center-right parliamentary majority, and that was very problematic for them or caused all sorts of issues. Obviously, most famously, Mitterrand, relatively early in his tenure, had a sort of a midterm loss that ended up with the party switching, and they had this kind of uncomfortable co-rulership by him and Jacques Chirac, who later became president but was then the prime minister. And he just ended up pursuing a whole bunch of center-right policies as a socialist, and I think that that's what you would probably see here as well. But, you know, like, there's been various comparisons made between Macron and Hillary Clinton, but as a lot of folks have pointed out, you know, to give Hillary Clinton credit, she wasn't running on some of the horrible stuff that Macron was running on, like openly talking about smashing unions and rolling back labor rights. You know, that's what Macron was going around saying that he was going to do, and that's not what Hillary Clinton was campaigning on, and this is what he managed to get elected on. Now, you know, I saw some stat that said 46% of his voters said they were voting against Le Pen rather than voting for him. So again, it's not like he has this huge mandate, although he may interpret it as such. But, you know, my point being that he would be very comfortable, as I guess Bill Clinton ultimately was in, you know, after the 94 midterms, of working with a sort of prime ministership by the center right party.
Just make some deals. It's the art of the deal. Another part of this Financial Times article I'm looking at is also about the Republicans and how they plan to work with Macron. So some of the moderates, as I was saying, they want a chance to work in the new administration, possibly get some posts or just work with them. One-time presidential hopeful Bruno Le Maire said, as a man of the right, I think there's an open door, a chance of a useful five-year government. I say let's seize it. But then he says he's also been threatened from expulsion from his party, from senior colleagues who want to go into the elections opposed to Macron. So that's something to look at. There's also the question of what will be Macron's his cabinet. That hasn't been announced yet. He's saying that he may want to have a commando of 15 ministers, and one third of whom will come out from outside of the current political elite, although most will probably have come from all the elite institutions anyway, but they'll just be
right. But I assume what
outside.
He means is like how he was the finance minister without a political background, you know, very similarly, you know, getting people who haven't held office before. That was actually something we were talking about a couple weeks ago on the show when Jonathan was here about the, you know, Italy with the sort of externally appointed leadership to pursue this austerity agenda, which is essentially what Macron campaigned on. You know, and maybe he'll, for example, maybe he'll keep the, you know, the folks from the Green Party that are in the the French Green Party that are in the cabinet now under the socialists, you know, so, you know, they, I think if I remember correctly, I don't think they're currently heading the portfolio for the environment. I'm pretty sure that's Ségolène Royal, who's a former Socialist Party nominee for president. But, you know, typically, you know, they'll find some portfolio that's relevant to give them. That would be kind of unlikely or unthinkable, probably, I'm guessing, under a center-right president. But if he's running as this sort of post-partisan, non-ideological thing or whatever, you could potentially hand that off to a Green Party person if they wanted to be part of that government. Well, I don't know that they would, but, you know, who knows?
And so there's also the question of who's going to be his prime minister. They're saying that he'll name that in about a week or so, 15 May. So that's something to look at. There's also the question of, who's he going to pick for what different portfolios, what different administrations? There's been talk. There's one, there's the François Bayrou is from sort of the centrist movement, centrist democratic movement, sort of similar to Macron in a lot of ways. He could get a position. Alain Juppé, former Republicans, presidential hopeful, mayor of Bordeaux, could be, I guess he's being considered for a public transport administration or economy ministry, I guess. So that's something where they could bring in some former Republicans and then hopefully maybe keep on some Greens. You never know. So you'd rather have that than just go fully over to the Republicans. But, you know, it's hard to say.
I think, though, it's something that's worth underscoring, which does not get understood properly often in U.S. discussions or even sometimes, I think, British discussions, is that the parliament, the National Assembly in France right now is relatively weak. You know, the Fourth Republic right after World War II, you know, in the 1950s, that was a parliamentary system where the emphasis was on the prime minister. But then that got changed after de Gaulle came back to power. And the Fifth Republic is a presidential system. It's a weaker presidency than it used to be. It used to be 7-year terms and that kind of thing, which was a bit much. But now it's 5-year terms. But the president can still really do a lot of stuff essentially by decree, you know, or just with his cabinet. And it tends not to require that much input or consent from the National Assembly in the way that we would expect in, like, the U.S., where the president can really be stymied by Congress not being on the same page with him. You know, sometimes they'll have to go ram something through like they did with the Macron law, you know, back a few years ago with the socialists in the assembly. But in general, the French president can do a lot of stuff, very similarly to how the Spanish prime minister, Mariano Rajoy, has relied very heavily on so-called royal decrees. Now, in Spain, they actually do have a monarchy, so it's called a royal decree. But what it fundamentally is the prime minister just issuing a decree. And you don't really get that much input from the king or anything. In this case, it's very similar. You would issue like a presidential decree, and then that's just how it goes. And there's not a whole lot of input that people have. So I think we need to, you know, obviously there's some role played, you know, like I think they have to approve who the prime minister is, for example, and ratify the cabinet. But other than that, there really is, it shouldn't be overstated the role that parliament can play for or against the president of France. It's a very strong presidential system.
Right, and that's what Mélenchon was partially running on. He said he wanted to end the dictatorship of the presidency in France, basically calling for a sixth republic to come forward and, you know, change constitution, do whatever, have another national assembly or something like that to reduce the sort of overall power of the presidency, maybe try and move it back towards a system more focused on the parliament or a prime minister and whatnot. So that's part of the problem here.
Right. And that's kind of been a traditional seesaw within French history, which is, you know, France, unlike, say, Britain, had a absolute monarchy and a very strong central state a lot earlier than a lot of other countries. And that has very much informed, you know, sort of attitudes toward government. Usually the longest standing system tends to be a very strong singular central executive with immense power over the whole state, including Paris, but also the rest of the country. And then when people are upset about something, they take to the streets, you know, form barricades, occupy campuses, go on strike, things like that. And that's how they express kind of opposition to how things are going. There have been other periods of parliamentarism. Obviously, the Third Republic was one of the longest running, but that was sort of an accidental creation. I was looking up something about that actually today. because I was interested in some, kind of which branches of the royal family were still around. They apparently, the Third Republic, which was created after the Franco-Prussian War, they thought they were creating a temporary, like a temporary constitution until they could give back power to one of the like royal claimants that wasn't a Bonapartist after they had deposed the emperor. But instead, the guy didn't die as soon as they were hoping because they didn't like the current like claimant to the throne at the time. So they were waiting for like his son to be available or his nephew or something like that. And he didn't die fast enough. So then they just were like, well, I guess we're with this system for now. And then they just kept it until the disaster in World War II. And then there was, as I said, there was also a post-war period of parliamentarism. But generally, that has not been the case. More often, there has been a strong singular executive. With all the attendant problems that brings, and then people just, you know, they get angry and take to the streets and shut things down if they want to change directions, you know, in the country. And obviously there's also a whole, like, civil service system that is, you know, kind of not, like, it's doing its own thing independently of the assembly. But, you know, this has been kind of a long-running conflict, is like, how much should there be? And it's the same thing even in during the French Revolution, that was a huge debate, you know, should there be a French constitutional monarchy, should there be, you know, no monarchy at all, should there be any executive figure, should it be an executive committee? And that's
committee of public safety, perhaps.
Well, that is ultimately the model that was temporarily adopted, and we don't know what would have happened because it only lasted for about, you know, like 14 months or so. We don't know what would have happened if they had gone back to the constitution that they were, you know, basically trying to stabilize the peace to implement. But, you know, they had kind of been gravitating toward this model, which was kind of like the Articles of Confederation in the United States, of having an executive committee that was like responsible or answerable to the legislature and was just supposed to, you know, execute the functions that the rest of the legislature had decided. But that kind of notion of the laws really originating from the parliament has kind of fallen again by the wayside, and it's only nominal, which is sort of similar to how things are done in Britain as well. Like, the cabinet has a lot of influence there and so forth, but ultimately the prime minister in Britain is answerable to the parliament, you know, and that reflects kind of the history of parliamentary power there, which itself comes from sort of the diffused power with all the nobility, you know, rival power centers in Britain and the various, you know, petty bourgeoisie and that sort of thing. So that kind of colors how things developed in various countries differently.
I'm looking forward to seeing how everything shakes out with the parliamentary elections, seeing if Mélenchon's party actually picks up any seats, how the socialists do, whether they completely collapse and disappear or whether they sort of remain. And then how, of course, Marche, whether they, you know, form this massive ruling coalition or they just sort of are just there and battle with a bunch of other different equivalent parties. So we'll see.
All right. Well, Arsenal for Democracy will be back in just a moment from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. Stick around. Democracy. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill, and still in studio with me is Nate. So we've been talking so far this hour about the recent French presidential election. We're going to talk a little bit more about some things that have been going on in the United States and what that maybe signifies. The healthcare bill, obviously kind of the biggest thing that's been going on lately, you know, but I'm reminded of, like, in the aftermath of this French presidential election vote, for some reason, people who think that all politics is the same everywhere were making a lot of comparisons that were not necessarily on target, I think. Not surprising.
There were frères de Mélenchon that were going to cause Le Pen to get elected, I believe.
Right. But they kind of were like thinking that a Clintonian figure had prevailed in this election and somehow, like, not really understanding the differences or similarities, or I don't know. It was just kind of a messy comparison. But, you know, just really getting excited that this sort of like neoliberal centrist guy had won this election and being like, this proves that we should do the same in U.S. congressional elections, which is just kind of a bizarre strategy that's not really based in anything, I would argue. There was also a moment, I think, that along similar lines of not kind of really just not being in touch with things. When the health care bill passed, the Republican health care bill passed the House, you had Democrats singing on the floor of the House.
Hey, 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 goodbye.
Yeah.
And not a great look.
Right, which made it sound like it was for the bill, but actually they, like, the, you know, the Obamacare was going away, so people first thought it was the Republicans singing, and then they realized, no, it's the Democrats singing, because they think that this bill passing will somehow automatically cause all these people to lose their seats. But, like, you know, as Jonathan Cohn pointed out right away, as soon as it happened, like, you know, they also thought that the government shutdown in 2013 was going to lead to automatic losses for the Republicans. And it almost did. It probably, you know, it could have in 2014, except that immediately after that happened, the healthcare.gov website debacle happened, and it instantly erased all the polling gains. And so you never know what's going to happen. Like, there's always so much stuff that can go right or wrong in, you know, go in either direction. You know, this notion that you can just sit back and let this implode is just bizarre and terrible, and that's obviously not the way to go. Let's drill down, though, a little bit into this bill, and then also I want to talk about what's going to happen in the Senate potentially, or what we think might happen in the Senate. Nate, what are some of the highlights or lowlights, as it were, of this American Health Care Act bill that finally made it through the House?
Well, as you and I were just discussing, what's going to happen with people with various types of pre-existing conditions, that could be potentially hugely significant. So as we were discussing, it's not so much that it would ban people with pre-existing conditions from getting health care, but just create situations where they would be getting much more expensive health care that basically wouldn't cover a lot of hugely necessary procedures and things like that. So while it might not technically, you know, fulfill the qualifications there, it would be extremely dangerous for people who had really any type of these pre-existing conditions. In addition, you're also, I guess, seeing all sorts of the House Republican plan would convert a lot of the Obamacare subsidies into tax credits and other types of things. Those might not survive with the Senate reconciliation process or the Senate's version of the bill and then being reconciled. So we're going to have to see how that all turns out. And yeah, I guess we're just seeing now the House or the Senate Republicans are forming a commission, all male, and none of the moderates or people that could potentially have some moderating influence, such as, say, Susan Collins of Maine, who has already said that she wants to start fresh with the Senate bill. So it's unclear exactly how things are going to turn out with this Senate bill. But unfortunately, what we're now seeing being reported today is that the chair of the House Freedom Caucus, the people that are very influential in terms of the conservative Republicans getting their votes through the House, Mark Meadows, House Freedom Caucus chairman, has said he's been working with Senate Republicans on what changes the House conservatives could live with, basically saying that they know the Senate bill is going to change a little bit, but it's unclear how much it's going to change, and they could really get pretty much a lot of what they want. I mean, Bill, you're pretty pessimistic about how this whole thing is going to go down.
Well, once again, this automatic assumption that you can just sit back and let a thing happen and it's going to go the way you want is, I mean, that's not how politics works. These people have been in this for decades. And I mean, I guess it's also why they've been losing so many seats in so many elections. But man, I mean, how do you get to this position, this high in the government and just be like, oh, now we just sit back and drink martinis and this will all work itself out? That's not how anything works. The Republicans are going to want to keep working on this and try to get something through. It was sort of a core campaign thing. It's going to be really bad if they don't get it done in terms of their own, base. And there will be a lot of people running against them from the right if they don't get it done. Here's my take on the Senate situation. I think they're probably going to have to come up with some incentives to get certain senators in the Republican caucus to vote for this. Some of them may just not vote for it at all, but they have 52 senators, you know, a 53rd vote if Mike Pence is there, if you need to break a tie. And I think it goes through by reconciliation. I think either it's easy to make the argument that it's going to reduce the deficit because it will. I don't know. I haven't followed the scoring that closely. Or as happened with the Bush tax cuts, way back in, I want to say it was either 2001 or 2003, I forget which round of the Bush tax cuts, they literally just fired the parliamentarian because he said that it didn't, you know, reduce the deficit. And they said, nope, it does, you know. And then if you have a spending measure like that that reduces the deficit, or you claim it does, then you can use the reconciliation procedures and get it through with just a simple majority. There's no filibuster, and you just need to have your 51 votes lined up. That means you could have potentially, I think, a couple, one or two defections or so, and still be able to have the vice president break that tie and get that through if you needed to. Back when the Democrats were working on the healthcare bill, they eventually used reconciliation, but first they had to pass a version of the bill that did not use reconciliation, and so they needed their 60 votes. I don't think that would be the case here. It's much easier to repeal a program that way than to create one from scratch. But also, when they did that first round where they needed 60 senators, the Democrats put in these very controversial and sketchy things, nicknamed things like the Cornhusker kickback, that kind of thing, where it was like, oh, here's a special sweetheart deal within the program for extra funding for Nebraska because we want the senator from Nebraska to vote for this. What is likely to happen, given the territory that Republicans currently represent, is that if there's someone who's not a true believer, or they're, maybe feeling electoral pressure or something like that, you just give them some extra Medicaid funding if they were a state that had already accepted Medicaid funding, or maybe come up with a new one if they, if they're like, they didn't do it in their state. I think Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski, who just got reelected, she in particular would be someone who's probably a little uncomfortable voting for this bill, despite the fact that the congressman from Alaska voted for it in the House. She might say, well, this is going to really, really hurt our funding for rural medical treatment in Alaska, and we have a impoverished population and an indigenous population, that sort of thing. We need a lot of Medicaid funding. There's not a lot of economies of scale in Alaska because of how things are spread out in terms of healthcare delivery. So you say, okay, we'll give you some Medicaid funding for Alaska and come up with some justification for why it's just going to Alaska, and then maybe we'll get your vote. And I think that you can continue to do that as needed to build together a selection of people. You may say, oh, well, maybe then the House wouldn't vote for it. I think that if the Senate were to pass something substantively similar to the House bill, I think the House would go along with it, seeing that they are finally within reach. I don't think they wanted to make compromises on something that they didn't even know if it was going to get through the Senate. If it's gone through the Senate and it's pretty close, I think that there's a chance like that. The other thing to consider, and then Nate can fill us in on some of these details, is that there are a lot more senators in so-called Trump voting states who are from the Democratic side that are up in 2018 than Republican senators. There's really only two. And, I think we've already had maybe one defection from the senator from Nevada for that reason, Republican senator. So that's one defection. So there's a narrow margin here. But a lot of the Republicans you might consider to be extremely vulnerable on this are people who either just got reelected or got reelected a couple years before that. And that means that they have 4 to 6 years left on their terms. That's going to really embolden them, I think, to vote for a really, really terrible piece of legislation, because unfortunately, memories, especially within the political media, are kind of short, and people aren't necessarily going to remember, in 2022 to vote out this person based on their, how they voted on something. Not to mention, if this goes to multiple versions, you may see a situation where they come up with basically a dud version of the bill that a bunch of senators can cast votes against, and then you come up with the actual version of the bill that they vote through, and then they can go back to their constituents 6 years from now when no one remembers how they voted, or 5 years from now or whatever, and say, look, I did vote against it. Remember, here's the bill that I voted against. And people are going to go, I don't really remember, how this played out. And so I think that's going to make it, there's a lot of people saying a lot of compelling arguments for why it won't pass the Senate, but I would rather be active and prepared on this than get blindsided.
Yeah. One thing that sort of maybe supports that a little bit is that a bunch of the Republican senators as part of this working group are from states that have expanded their Medicaid in recent years. And the House bill would cut about $80 billion from or $800 billion of Medicaid over 10 years, basically rolling back the Medicaid expansion, which has covered about 11 million people as part of as part of ACA. And as a part of it, that you could say it's just, blanket a good thing that Medicaid was expanded, and you can have all sorts of criticisms of ACA, but probably better those people are getting Medicaid than not. So, but I think it's important to point out that Alexander, Orrin Hatch, they're on the committee there, but Tom Cotton from Arkansas had a big Medicaid expansion, Cory Gardner from Colorado, Rob Portman from Ohio, Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania, They're all in there. So they're from states that have expanded Medicaid under the ACA. And so I guess part of the question is, are they going to be able to be gotten on board for the House bill or some modified version of the House bill where they get to keep some of their Medicaid expansion, or there's some sort of, you know, way of buying them off? And another part of it may be the House Republicans compromising a bit on the tax credit subsidy versus the Obamacare subsidy versus tax credits. You actually have Mark Meadows already saying, quoted here in Huffington Post, saying that conservatives may just take the changes to the Obamacare subsidies. He's saying the fundamental question is going to come down to the tax credit subsidy in place, or do they drop back to an Obamacare modified subsidy, maybe split the difference there, or do some version of both, or find some way where they can get it through both the Senate and the Freedom Caucus there in the House. So, I mean, that's really the sort of fulcrum point in all of this. How are they going to get it through and keep as many of their, you know, corporate giveaways and various ways to kick people off healthcare to provide profit? So, and that's ultimately what it's all about. So that's the question. And, you know, I think that people are being a little bit too, oh, it's not going to pass, don't worry about it, it's not a huge deal, when it could potentially have really devastating impacts.
Yeah, I just, that's the kind of the core point that I keep wanting to try to underscore here, is just that you have to be active on this. You have to actually do stuff. Yeah,
we need
it, right?
People having rallies, we need all sorts, right, of stuff, because that's not happening right,
yeah,
now.
Yeah, and there were rallies in was it December, I think, or something, about, you know,
yeah,
save our,
yeah,
care. But the other thing,
that
of course,
now.
Right. The other thing, of course, too, is, yeah, we need to be doing more of these sustained pressure, that sort of things. They need to not just be in blue cities that are all represented by Democratic congressmen and, you know, senators. We definitely, like,
yeah, this needs to happen in those, like, the capitals of the red states and other towns in the,
right,
the
there
states
was a,
where there
we
were Medicaid expansion.
We talked about the
Arkansas,
Salt Lake City rally, yeah, that happened, you know, and I think Martin O'Malley was at that one. You know, like, that was a pretty good turnout, but, like, let's keep doing more of those. Let's get more of these together. And also, you know, I mean, we've said this before so many times on the show, let's go on the offensive with an actual plan, because the problem is that right now Democrats are basically, you know, if they are lifting a finger against this, the elected Democrats are generally saying basically just that they want to preserve the status quo.
Yeah, that's not good enough.
And it's not good enough in general, but it's not good enough when you have millions of people that are still uninsured. And you know, their counter argument is always, oh, well, we have a system that's starting to work and we just need to keep making fixes to it and improvements. I'm sorry, you can't move the number of millions of voters that you need to move all over this country in 2018 and 2020 running on minor fixes. It's not going to cut it. You have to present something simple, straightforward, and all-encompassing, and that is Medicare for all, probably. The idea that you're going to rally people to come, you know, who didn't come out and vote for you or whatever, you know, or the tons of people who stayed home, to avoid a situation like what we saw in France with, you know, second places, you know, no vote, right?
Well, that did, like, happen in the U.S. as well, because, yeah, there were many, and we can look up the exact numbers of this, of whether it could have tipped any races or not, and I think it probably could have in the upper Midwest, but there were people just voting, you know, down ballot, but just leaving the presidential race blank. They didn't want to vote for Hillary, and they didn't want to vote for Trump, so.
Right, and, you know, the only way that we come back from this is by running candidates that are going to run on something huge and motivating and big. And the notion that you're going to somehow lose voters on the, you know, to your, on your right flank or something by pursuing that, I mean, that's just not the number of voters. When you're looking at a situation where Hillary Clinton, like many presidential winners in modern times, you know, she came in first in the popular vote, yet finished behind non-voters out of registered voters. That shows you that there's a huge pool to draw from among non-voters who tend to be either, you know, to your left or non-political or something. And if you run on something that's going to materially change their circumstances, that's going to help a lot. You have to be running on things that are actually going to improve, like, everyone's lives in a meaningful way, that they say, okay, this is a reason to come out and vote. This is a reason to go put a Democratic majority in, you know, progressive majority, whatever you want to call it. And just saying, oh, we're going to tinker around and fix this is not really making the case. It's also just like a lot of people have had a lot of issues with the Affordable Care Act. And so running on, oh, we want to keep exactly what we have is also not going to cut it for those people. And I know a lot of Democrats in office are really like not understanding that. I don't think it's, some of it is obviously willfully opposing it, but I think some of them just genuinely somehow have convinced themselves that it would be a distraction to pursue something bigger. But it's
some have been signing on to various single payer Medicare for all proposals, but you know, it's some chunk of the party. And then the rest of the party seems to be digging its heels in and screaming and doubling down on the various failed strategies that sort of got us this far. And to go back to the presidential race for a second, I mean, anyone who was even nominally paying attention to politics, maybe they weren't even politically engaged, but they could tell you what Trump was running on. He had a very clear message. You know, he would say all sorts of crazy things, but you could boil it down pretty well. And, you know, people recognized that he wanted to build the wall, you know, and all of these other sort of basic things, whether it was fear-mongering against immigrants or Muslims, or even basic things like that he was against free trade, wanted to bring jobs back, and was breaking with Republican orthodoxy on things like Social Security, and even said, okay, everyone's going to get health care. And clearly that's not what's going to happen now. But I mean, that's sort of what it was running on versus, and I mentioned this in a previous episode, you know, the Clinton campaign pretty much was just running on Donald is dangerous. We're not Donald. And, you know, Hillary is prepared. She has the right resume. So therefore, you know, she's the best, rather than actually showing how her policies were really going to impact the average, you know, the average person. And there wasn't that message being put out. So if you don't have that, or if you don't have the policies to back that up, as too many elected Democrats do, then we're really stuck.
And although a lot of candidates down ballot have been trying to tie, you know, to relate things to the Donald Trump administration for the purposes of making a case for getting elected or whatever, or why they're running, I am very skeptical that just running at every single office against Donald Trump alone is going to cut it. I think a lot of people are going to say, well, we have a Republican official in this particular office and he's not Donald Trump, you know, and they're just going to leave it at that. Even if he's maybe worse than Trump, like they're, you know, a lot of people, this applies at all kinds of levels. And this is partly why, you know, the phenomenon you were talking about where people, they knew who Hillary Clinton was, they knew who Donald Trump was, and they didn't like either of them, so they didn't vote in that. But they took themselves to that polling place and voted for their, you know, county commissioner or their, you know, city council candidate or whatever else was on the ballot. The phenomenon that we see constantly is that people greatly overestimate how good their incumbent person is and think that everyone else's is the problem. Right. And I mean, you know, we're in Joe Kennedy's district and we, you know, definitely encounter, like, Joe Kennedy's been great on a lot of stuff, but we will also encounter stuff where people will just assume, they won't even call to say, you know, what they want Joe Kennedy to do. Right. And so in some ways, that's not even his fault, because if he's not hearing from any of his constituents on a certain issue, you know, because they for some reason assume that he's already on board with a whole bunch of different things. Right. Then he's just going to say, well, no one's contacted my office to say that I should be on board with this, so I guess they don't want it. And, you know, again, you can criticize him for that attitude, but there's also a responsibility as a voter and as people in the community to know what your representative stands for, what they're on board with, and what you support and what you want. And this idea of just saying, like, you know, even if you have the greatest representative in the world, the idea that there's nothing they could improve on, or that, you know, you shouldn't have to even, oh, well, they're going to be fine, I don't need to check on them, so I'm not going to worry about it. That's a bad approach to politics. But that's what a lot of candidates are going to do, is they're just going to think, you know, well, everyone knows that this incumbent is horrible, right? Or everyone knows that they're aligned with Trump or something like that. And it's no, you gotta let people know. And you got to let them know what that means, for their lives. So a lot of people don't understand the mechanics of policy, and it's complicated. So yeah, it's difficult to explain it, but that's one of your jobs when you're running for office is to, you know, yeah, on the one hand, you need to have a simple message that conveys certain things to people very easily, but you also need to do an education campaign of saying, like, look, this is what your current incumbent is a supporter of, and they really need to not be supporting that, you know, or you need to get rid of them if you want someone who isn't going to support that.
Yeah, and Bill, you went to a town hall believe, a couple weeks ago with Joe Kennedy. And so sort of just maybe speak to your experiences there a little bit there, what was talked about and how you sort of came out, because I remember you had some strong feelings at the end of that.
So there were some problems. Like, I thought that he spent a lot of time talking about Russia and then for some reason also North Korea and just kind of being really hawkish toward North Korea. And that just seemed weird to me just because, like, I don't know that that's where the most American public is focusing on right now.
I don't really think the American people really have a desire to attack North Korea.
Right. I don't think so either. And it wasn't like he was advocating for that, but just this, like, you know, oh, that this is a really scary regime that's doing X, Y, and Z. And it's like, yeah, but that doesn't, like, even if North Korea goes to war, right, they may demolish South Korea and the capital of South Korea in the process of this war, even if the U.S. quote unquote wins it.
They do something,
and there will be a lot of U.S. troops that would be killed when North Korea is rolling over if this were to happen, right? Which I don't think it will, but if it were to happen, that still isn't going to materially affect most people's lives in the United States. They're not going to be launching missiles into the U.S. as horrible as it would be, and so it's just strange to focus that much on that issue. The other thing was that, you know, someone asked him about the Medicare for All bill, and he kind of had this, you know, the standard answer that I've been talking about, which is just the, I don't want us to get distracted right now from pushing back on this, or, you know, I'm not sure that I agree with the specific substance of those bills, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, he had an explanation and people seemed satisfied with that explanation. And that was kind of troubling to me because I didn't find the explanation that persuasive. And I'm not trying to pick on him here in particular.
Right.
We're just, he happens to be our
right.
congressman.
Yeah. And,
so, yeah. And he's a well-known name.
Yeah. And I think I've made the contrast too. I mean, I think there's a couple congressmen, I think there's one recently elected, Ro Khanna, out in sort of the Silicon Valley. And I've seen, you know, criticisms of him too close to Silicon Valley industry, all of that. But for example, he's supporting Medicare for All. There's various other Democrats in probably districts that are not as Democratic friendly as this one that are supporting Medicare for All. So you sort of wonder, okay, what's going on? We need to pressure our local representatives more. Yeah, and
we've got other reps from Massachusetts that are co-sponsoring it. Barney Frank, you know, who's the predecessor to Joe Kennedy, he was a co-sponsor on this bill in previous sessions. You know, and we've talked about this bill before, you know, with Greg or Jonathan or whoever. So again, it's not really about Kennedy, but just this point that there needs to be a back and forth public dialogue and engagement with the representatives. And making sure that they're getting on the right track. And I think that, you know, without having a central leader in the Democratic Party and with a lot of these party institutions like the DCCC or the DNC kind of atrophying for a long time and not really understanding how, like,
giving money to critical races.
Exactly. Like. They don't understand necessarily how to win. They don't understand where they need to win. And they also are just kind of doing make work for consultants, that kind of thing. That's going to leave it to a lot of us to say, to get our representatives wherever we live on board with specific pieces of legislation. If folks want to hit me up about that, Bill Humphrey MA on Twitter, or you can email the show. I think it's afdradio@gmail.com. You can get a list from me of various specific bills that I am personally, you know, putting my name behind for this session, even if they're not perfect, that I've decided that they are kind of the things we want to be sponsoring. You know, obviously the Family Act with, you know, Kirsten Gillibrand and Rosa DeLauro, that is the paid maternity leave. We've talked about that before on the show. Things like the Medicare for All Conyers bill, things like the Disclose Act, things like, you know, the Stop Tax Haven Abuse Act, things like that. You know, there's a lot of these bills. You can get a list of those from me. These are the kind of things that I want people to be getting their reps on board with, because, yeah, it's not going to pass this session, but then we'll be able to go to voters and say, look, this is a comprehensive agenda. And you don't have to go tell the voters these are the specific bills. You can just say, you know, in 2018, if you give us a Democratic majority, we're going to get you universal health care. We're going to stop these, you know, abusive tax practices by major corporations. You know, we're going to come up with the money to fund infrastructure. We're going to come up with the, you know, paid maternity leave, like all these different things that you can say that are big ticket items. And if you need to revise the details in the next session, you can, but you want to get on board with these big ideas that people know what they're going to get if they vote for you.
Yeah, and I think one of the secrets to the Republican strategy over the past several decades is that they've had these institutions like ALEC, where they have these pre-made bills that are just ready to go, just to make everything perfect for, you know, the corporations or whatever nefarious agenda they're going after in that case. So we need to build institutions that are putting forward policy agendas, and there have been some proposals that have come up even recently, or, you know, groups that are trying to get together to create these kind of working environments where we combat people like Alec and actually put forward a, you know, a progressive agenda or a socialist agenda or whatever, you know, what have you, that, you know, instead of just throwing it back to the Democrats and, oh, you know, you can just negotiate amongst yourselves and then probably be advised by various lobbyists and then have it out with the Republicans. And then we're supposed to hope that it all turns out fine by the end. But in reality, that's just probably going to be various corporate handouts one way or the other. So
there's one note that I want to close on, because we've been talking a lot about the need to kind of actively resist this stuff, even if you're pessimistic like me and you think that something like the healthcare bill is going to get through the Senate. As we're recording this, it's Monday, May 8th, which is the anniversary of the end of the European front of World War II. A lot of people had thought for a long time, kind of like, you know, when the American Civil War is like, there was a certain point in the war where you're like, okay, this is probably over at some point. Like, it's, we don't know what point it's going to be over, but we know how this is going to come out. But the thing that I kept thinking about, you know, last week with this healthcare bill is about those kind of late battles in the war. I don't know if you saw, I wrote about this a little bit at arsenalfordemocracy.com, but these late battles in the war that kind of go the opposite direction from the war, because there's a lot of like sense of kind of despair and hopelessness right now about how things are going that I don't think was even as grim as things were last year. I think before the election, people had the sense of hope that things were maybe starting to go in the right direction. When stuff like this healthcare bill passes the House, I think a lot of people, you know, feel really despairing about it and kind of wonder if things are really going in the complete wrong direction and we're not going to turn things around. But I was thinking about the Battle of the Bulge, which was in December 1944. And that is, you know, well past the point where they thought, okay, it's inevitable that we're going to defeat Nazi Germany. It's just a question of how long it's going to take. And Hitler came up with this, you know, this campaign where he was going to divert a whole bunch of military resources to the front in France and the Low Countries. And he was going to, you know, do a blitzkrieg maneuver like how he had invaded France 4 years earlier or over 4 years earlier. He's going to smash through the Allied lines and surround four separate Allied armies, cut off their, you know, supply chains from the ports, and not necessarily defeat them, but basically force them to sign a separate peace, which would retain Nazi Germany in power within Germany, not the rest of Europe, and then they would concentrate on winning their war against the Soviet Union. Now, a lot of his generals thought this is probably crazy and isn't going to work, and it turned out that it didn't work. But if you were in that moment at the time, it must have been really scary to you know, have this sudden counteroffensive happen and think, oh, we thought we were going to win this war, and maybe it's not as inevitable as we thought. Maybe this is actually the turning point. It's going back in the other direction, and things are going to totally turn around. I wrote about this at arsenalfordemocracy.com, about this late kind of stage battle in Europe. After the battle was over, then it went back to this, like, oh, we're inevitably going to, you know, win this war. But in that moment, that must have been really scary. The idea that he had was they were going to do this lightning offensive. They were going to push through a bunch of this stuff really fast. They were going to force this capitulation by the Allies, and it was going to work out how, you know, with a Nazi victory or partial victory in the war. This is kind of the strategy that the Republicans were proposing before they took office at the beginning of this year, you know, before Trump became the president. They said they were going to, you know, we're going to get a national right to work bill through. We're going to get Obamacare repealed. We're going to reform the civil service. We're going to, you know, do all this immigration reform stuff that's really strict. And they initially tried, right? They tried on some of those executive orders. They signed that executive order, I think, the other day about the religious freedom provision, basically the right to discriminate against people. There were all these things that they were going to do, but at each stage, people have fought tooth and nail against these specific attacks. That is critically important, because what happened in the Battle of the Bulge was that his entire strategy against the Allies on the Western Front was to get past them and around them as fast as possible so they didn't have time to react and he could cut them off and that would end that part of the war. And instead, what happened is that a ton of Allied soldiers basically figured out all the choke points, the critical roads that they needed to get through, and they stopped it there. And every tank that they prevented from getting through, or every, you know, plane that they shot down over that position, it cost a lot of Allied lives, but it stopped the advance from getting through as fast as it needed to get through. And every time that they failed to get through at a specific point, it prevented them from linking up on the other side and actually executing this counteroffensive plan. And I think we're at a very similar point here too, which is that it can feel like that there's a crisis happening every day and stuff is melting down and it's totally hopeless and they're going to get through whatever their agenda is. But this is a discombobulated and disorganized sort of last stand that the Republicans are making, even if it doesn't look like it right now. It is a last stand if we are actually stopping this counteroffensive at every possible point.
For actually seizing the choke points.
Yes. You have to seize those choke points, and you have to actually stop the advance from happening. Because if you don't, if you sit back and say, oh, no, it's inevitable,
the pans are just going to roll right over
you. They're going to roll over you, they're going to roll through you, they're going to roll around you, they're going to cut you off, and it is going to be over, and you will have lost. And that despair that people are feeling right now will come to pass if we do not stop the advance at every single possible point. If they're going to cut the EPA, we just got the Senate Democrats and everyone, they stopped it was supposed to be like a 40% budget cut or something. They got it to a 1% budget cut in that spending measure. That's a temporary spending measure, so they're going to have to refight this at the next position. But they held it to 1% instead of 40%. That's an area where the Republicans failed to advance on a critical point that they had been saying for years they were going to finish off once and for all as soon as they had that moment. If we stop them at every single point, if we do whatever it takes to stop them or delay them for as long as possible on every single point, then we can actually stop them. We can actually turn them back. We can prevent them from having this lightning counteroffensive that encircles us and actually destroys us. The advance that we're going to make toward the left is still going to happen if we are all together fighting on this and stopping them and delaying them at every single point. If a position falls at one given point, fall back to the next position and hold that. If the position behind that falls, I don't care, but everyone needs to stand in place and stop every single one of these from going for as long as you can hold out at that particular point. Because the longer you delay them on one thing, the longer you're delaying them from getting to the next thing. And in a very real sense, you could be saving thousands or millions of lives because of the policies that they are gutting, right? They are slashing policies for environmental health. They are slashing healthcare. They are slashing all of these different programs if they get their way. Millions of people will die if these policies are implemented. If we stop them at every single point and prevent this offensive from going forward, then we are actually saving thousands or millions of lives. And that means that it is the responsibility of all of us to put everything on the line now and stop them at every single point. And that is how we're going to make this like the Battle of the Bulge and turn them back. And that is how we're going to keep this from going the way that they think this is going to turn out. Nate, thank you so much for being here this week.
Thanks so much for that, Bill.
Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD, WVUD HD1, and WVUD HD2 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night. We'll